This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Often characterised as a bumbling, opportunistic amateur with a tin ear, Charles Mountford's extraordinary career as a discoverer and promoter of Aboriginal art is overdue for assessment, reassessment. His original manuscripts have been little studied and contain rich insights. Among the most telling for the purposes of this conference is a letter he received in January 1956 from a young American anthropologist who would become one of the most influential specialists in Aboriginal art, laying the basis for much of its contemporary academic interpretation. Nancy Munn had arrived in Canberra during late 1955 and was soon to begin her extended intensive fieldwork among the Walpri at Yuendamu. She laid out her research proposal for Mountford and wrote, a little plaintively, quote, "There is no one here who both understands the problem of Aboriginal art and of art in general and who knows the Australian field. Thus I am relying on your knowledge and interest for guidance." Significantly, Munn's letter arrived before Mountford published his extensive work on the Arnhem Land Expedition, Art, Myth and Symbolism. Her appreciation was founded on Mountford's 1930s journal articles describing Western desert art. Another letter has a bearing on this session. It was written by the person to whom a young and brilliant anthropology student of the 1950s, such as Munn, might have been expected to defer. Mountford's old enemy, A.P. Elkin, head of the University of Sydney's Anthropology Department. It was Elkin who had vetoed Mountford's otherwise successful application for a Carnegie Fellowship to pursue his study of Aboriginal art in the Western Desert during 1940. In May 1945, hearing of Mountford's appointment as leader of the Arnhem Land Expedition, Elkin wrote to Gilbert Grosvenor, whose photograph we saw earlier, Secretary of the National Geographic Society, urging that an anthropologist be appointed. Quote, "Mr. Mountford," Elkin wrote, "who is a good photographer, especially of still subjects, and who has done valuable work in the recording and copying of native art, is not a trained social anthropologist, much to his own regret." What was it that annoyed Elkin so much about Mountford? Was it that he was an ingenue, a self-taught dilettante who's dabbling in art and populist lectures, films and publications, threatened to overshadow the fragile and complex plant Elkin was nurturing in the hothouse atmosphere of the Sydney University Anthropology Department? Perhaps Mountford's robust approach to anthropology and art, untutored and unconstrained by theory, informed by an international comparative approach, and founded on direct transactions with the artists themselves, exposed insecurities in the new discipline. This paper explores some of the background to Mountford's methodologies and examines how he was able to maintain his research activity on an expedition which quickly became a torrid ordeal for its leader. Mountford was encouraged and funded by Adelaide anthropologists and ethnographers whose intensive team methodology was at odds with Elkin's individual model of participant observation. During the 1930s, Mountford had participated in three of the annual Board for Anthropological Research expeditions to Central Australia. During these, Mountford had become familiar with a multidisciplinary expedition composed of diverse experts, mostly in the fields of physical anthropology and natural history, all more qualified than he. During a packed fortnight to 3 weeks, they interacted closely with a large group of Aboriginal people, usually more than 100, person by person, obtaining sociological data and physical measurements according to the scientists' own specializations, recording song and ceremony and material culture processes, collecting artifacts, and in the case of Tyndale and Mountford, obtaining hundreds of crayon drawings on large sheets of brown paper depicting mythological routes and sites. In contrast, Elkin's field workers were trained to work over a long period, becoming accepted by an Aboriginal group, learning the language and applying specialised anthropological skills to analyse a social network essentially undisturbed by their presence. If this could be described in fishing terms as careful angling across several seasons, the Adelaide approach was more like one afternoon's intensive trawling. That said, the results of those Adelaide expeditions, including thousands of photographs, genealogies, film and sound recordings, are arguably more tangible and useful today, both to Aboriginal people and to researchers. The crayon drawings gathered by Tyndale and Mountford not only represent the precursors of the Western Desert Art Movement as documents of traditional knowledge and land ownership, they also continue to play a key role in native title determinations. The crayon drawing technique had been pioneered by Daisy Bates and by Herbert Bazadeau as a means of delineating tribal territories and was refined by Norman Tyndale. The idea was to make the sheets of brown paper and crayons available to Aboriginal men and, to a lesser extent, women, later annotating the motifs on the finished works by interviewing each artist with an interpreter. In no case, it seems, did Tyndale and Mountford ever encounter blank sheets. Tyndale's comment during the 1940 Uldir expedition that the natives seemed to be tireless in their interest in their own drawings, each intent on his subject, and apparently oblivious to the efforts of others, unquote, is equally applicable to Mountford's experience. Later, following the expedition's return, the drawings would be assembled and analysed in relation to territorial boundaries or mythological trajectories, placed in context by reference to texts, songs or ceremonies recorded by expedition members. And in other words, what may appear now to have been a rapid and cheap method for gathering a priceless art collection was in fact a basic research tool with multiple possible outcomes. For Tyndale, these outcomes had much to do with his tribal boundary and mapping project. For Mountford in 1948, it had become an intertwined investigation of mythology and art in which evidence from primary sources, the bark paintings themselves, was supplemented by the publications of Elkin, the Burns, and especially Lloyd Warner. Following the 1948 expedition, Mountford was to write to Warner in the US, explaining how much he had relied on Warner's book, Black Civilization, in, quote, searching for details on some of the fragmentary myths that I had collected in connection with the bark paintings, end of quote, gathered during the expedition. Mountford's first expedition involving this technique was with Tyndale and Cecil Hackett among Ngadjarra people of the Warburton Range in 1935. Later that year, he collected drawings from Lurcha and Anangu people and near Uluru. After almost 10 years spent locating and describing rock art for which there was no surviving Aboriginal knowledge in southern South Australia, this form of knowledge was a revelation for Mountford. And this is a photograph from his earlier work, followed by another. Mountford had previously resisted the temptation to speculate about the meaning of rock art motifs, but now he encountered a flood of authoritative data linking motifs not only with their immediate symbolic meanings, but with elaborate and lengthy mythological itineraries. The skills required to successfully document these links and to describe the art and its meanings derived from Mountford's experience as a meticulous recorder of rock art and his abilities as a clear and engaging writer. He neither needed anthropological training nor regretted its lack. The collegial partnerships behind the board expeditions had meant that little formal leadership was required. Each scientist knew his role and each contributed to the camp organisation. Mountford knew that the 1948 expedition posed a much greater organisational challenge, with formidable responsibilities and an untested team of strangers, but he assumed that as independent professionals their daily research activities would not require close direction, leaving him sufficient time to pursue his own research objectives. His experience with the board expeditions had given him a straightforward technique for realising those objectives. His preparation had involved simply laying in a stock of brown paper and crayons. For the 1948 expedition, he needed to organise the cutting of sufficient bark in the wet season, well ahead of commencement, and to be sure that there were sufficient quantities of ochre. Fred McCarthy was also aware of this requirement, and he and Mountford collaborated on ensuring that this was done through the Darwin Native Affairs Administration Office. 100 sheets of bark of an unspecified size were cut at Milangimbi by mid-April 1948 and were sent to Groote Eylandt for the expedition's use. It's likely, very likely, I think, that these sheets were further divided and even divided again and were used at Yirrkala, if not Oenpelly. The small size of the Arnhem Land barks, barely a fifth the size of those collected by Donald Thompson in 1941, can be attributed to a limited original supply of cut bark. Mountford also planned ahead in the matter of pigments. In January 1948, he contacted E.O. Stocker, who'd been cinematographer on the 1930s board expeditions, who also ran a paint company in Sydney, to order a stock of red ochre, yellow ochre, graphite, calcimine, and binding agents. None of the expedition publications or records so far examined offer clues as to whether these pigments were actually used during the Arnhem Land expedition. Ochre signature and sourcing projects currently underway may explore this intriguing question. Mountford gained something else through his association with the board. All of their members were used to rapid publication through specialist medical or scientific journals or through the transactions of the Royal Society of South Australia or the records of the South Australian Museum. Then, as now, publication helped to assure access to the very limited research funding available through the University of Adelaide or the Australian National Research Council. Approximately 110 scientific papers were published on these expeditions by board members, including Frank Fenner, who was with us today, I hope, he was earlier, from 1926 until 1939. And these included 9 papers by Mountford. He published another 21 papers on diverse topics, including Aboriginal art, during the same period. He also took the lead from Tyndale and began contributing newspaper articles using the funds to support his own research. This style of writing suited Mountford, and he used it more broadly, particularly as his ethnographic films began finding a wide audience. But his publications were not merely descriptive. He had grasped a central fact about Aboriginal art that had linked place, story and identity, and that the art of each cultural region comprised an essentially fixed corpus of symbols and motifs expressed differently by individual artists, but held as shared heritage and revealed in conjunction with song and ceremony to each generation. These insights accompanied Mountford to Arnhem Land and allowed him to start recording mythological details for bark paintings systematically from the expedition's first days on Groote Eylandt. Colin Simpson's observation at Oenpelly that each evening Mountford could be seen in his tent, surrounded by bark paintings writing up his notes, applied equally on Groote Eylandt and at Yirrkala. Mountford's long immersion in Aboriginal art, well before a market had emerged, and well before the phenomenon of known, let alone collectible, Aboriginal artists had emerged, predisposed him to think in terms of a universal artistic impulse shared by Aboriginal artists with artists from all cultures, presumably indeed with Mountford himself, who had won prizes for artistic photography. That's one of them, as early as 1923, when he'd worked for the Postmaster General in Darwin. Untrained in social anthropology, somewhat naively, Mountford wanted the Aboriginal artistic impulse to float free of totemic obligation, or free enough to transcend the parameters of customary relationship as delineated by Berndt and Elkin. Yet extraordinarily enough, Mountford did not use the observable talent of key individual artists to advance his argument. His push for international recognition of Aboriginal art saw him negotiating as early as 1938 with the Museum of Modern Art to host an exhibition in New York. Had it gone ahead, we may be certain that it would have promoted Aboriginal art as a corporate contribution to world culture, rather than elevating individual named Aboriginal artists. By the time of the Arnhem Land expedition, Mountford's looser interpretation, bordering on the notion of art for art's sake, was appealing to a wide international community of art historians, particularly Herbert Reed, Carl Schuster, Leonard Adam, Madeleine Rousseau, and even that doyen of rock art investigators, Abbé H. Bruel. These scholars were all concerned to trace universal themes in art history, and all corresponded with Mountford. These contacts and others with diverse anthropologists and curators gave Mountford a sense of credibility and purpose which rid him of the taint of the amateur, at least in the eyes of those regarding the expedition in a positive light. By this time, he had become an international authority in an emerging, exciting field. He knew that most of his expedition days would be spent on paperwork and administration, organising supplies, signing checks, smoothing out difficulties. The pressure was considerably relieved by his extraordinarily patient wife, Bessie, who undertook secretarial duties in her own tent, redrafting and typing his official correspondence, checking the accounts, providing, in Bill Harney's words, the backbone to the party. Even so, Mountford needed a contained and efficient strategy for obtaining artworks, particularly as he was usually confined to the camp. His solution was to engage a group of men at each of the three camps as general workers who would fetch and carry provisions as required, but who would also remain on the payroll as artists. And I stress payroll. He was actually paying money. Tobacco did become a medium of exchange, but these were paid artists. On Groote Eylandt, this pool of workers corresponds neatly with the artists documented in Mountford's notebooks. For Yirrkala and Owen Pelly, the correspondence is less obvious. The pool of workers and paid artists in those camps is identifiable from the expedition's records, but by then Mountford had ceased noting individual artists in his bark painting documentation. There are several reasons for this, and I'll go straight to the main one. If the expedition can be regarded as a three-act play, its crisis was reached early in the second act at Yirrkala. The precipitating event was the non-arrival and eventual reef stranding of the ship carrying the party's supplies, which we've heard about. The resultant uncertainty caused numerous problems. And despite his efforts, Mountford became the focus of discontent as key allegiances were formed between expedition members. It's not surprising that the chief American scientist, archaeologist Frank Setzler, formed a close working relationship with Fred McCarthy, Australian Museum archaeologist, not at that stage anthropologist. McCarthy already had a brief to obtain bark paintings for the Australian Museum and was soon on a collision course with Mountford. The catalyst was the presence, I suggest, of Howard Coate, the patrol officer deputed to the expedition by the Native Affairs branch in Darwin. Coates' first allegiance was to that office, which reported in turn to Canberra bureaucrats who were concerned primarily with the expedition's success as an exercise in generating publicity rather than knowledge. In the eyes of these bureaucrats, Mountford had been appointed for his abilities in making successful promotional films about Australia. The enthusiasm for collecting was seen as a distraction from that goal. I want to move just in the final minute or two to the event which nearly caused the expedition to unravel. I'm suggesting that Coate had relayed information ultimately to Elkin, which found its way back into the department and led to the visit of the officials to Yirrkala. Shortly after the expedition arrived, on the 10th of July, the Administrator of the Northern Territory, Arthur Driver, Acting Director of the Department of Information, Kevin Murphy, flew in, accompanied by the United States Consul in Adelaide. Mountford's tent was the venue. I'll just put that there for a bit of light relief, for a meeting between himself, Setzler, Driver and Murphy, during which, as the other scientists observed, voices were raised. Mountford was informed that he was relieved of the leadership which would pass to Setzler and that he was to confine his activities to photography and to producing the three films required. The delegation flew out that afternoon and the camp remained eerily quiet as the news circulated. But within 24 hours, the situation was reversed. The Americans met the following morning and Setzler was informed by his colleagues, led by ornithologist Bert Dagnan, that they still considered Mountford as the rightful leader. Setzler was forced to renounce the leadership by telegram and to apologise to Mountford. McCarthy and Coach remained silent, but they were regarded as complicit, if not instrumental. From that point, Mountford's leadership was unquestioned, but the pressures of administration continued to mount. His pared-down art-collecting methodology, giving precedence to mythological content over artistic provenance, became his only means of continuing research and ultimately forms the backbone of art, myth and symbolism. It is these events and undercurrents interlocking with the distinctive island, seashore and lagoon landscapes encountered by the expedition, not to mention the contrasting cultural groups of Aboriginal people and the three varying sets of mission practice and personnel at Angaroo, Yirrkala and Oenpelli, which make the expeditionary triptych of the Australian expedition to Arnhem Land a fascinating object of study. Mountford's great resilience as a field worker, sustained cheerfully by his wife and most of his colleagues, despite being undermined before, during and after the expedition, and his dogged commitment to obtaining a rich and durable record of Arnhem Land art, makes him a compelling central character in this revealing historic tableau of Australian art and science. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions. And forget to state your name.
Janie Anderson. I want to ask you what the essential skills of a social anthropologist would have been that Mountford lacked. I mean, right through your paper you had sort of very interesting comments about him in anthropology, but what would he have been missing that would have been what Elkin had, say?
Well, I think the key term is kinship. He would have been expected to produce genealogies, very detailed genealogies, and to ensure that the kinship relations of those people on the genealogies were fleshed out. One of the slides actually just here. This is Fred Rose's kinship terminology for Groot Island, which was interesting to think of Fred Rose as a communist, Professor Beasley's talk this morning, but anyway, that's another issue. This kinship diagram was given by Fred Rose to Mountford, and I think Elkin and company would have expected Mountford to expand this greatly and to link all of the activity, all of the ceremonial activity in particular, to a kinship template, and therefore to look at the system of obligation and reciprocity operating through the society. In other words, to infuse all of his work with this sociological interpretation. My feeling is that if he had done that, or if Mountford had not been the leader anthropologist, we simply would not have the collection that we have today in terms of the bark paintings.
One more question.
This last slide explains something that I've been involved with. After our 50th reunion, my wife and I went into the Art Gallery of Queensland, and in their Indigenous collection, they had one of the bark paintings, which, to me, grandfather, grandmother, all the children, all the grandchildren, a family tree. I couldn't believe that Mountford would have collected such an object. And I didn't race in to see Julie Ewington, but she immediately gave us a display of the 30 Bach paintings in Arnhem Land. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't believe that this would have ever been produced. That type of genealogical tree would have been produced by on behalf of Mount Hood.
Yes. I think he had the capacity. He'd shown that on the 1930s expeditions that he comprehended this, and it was an activity that was undertaken on those expeditions. But I think he knew that something had to give, and the intensity of the task confronting him was such that if he could just gather the Bach paintings and document them, and even there he fell down because he didn't always record the artist's name. But if he recorded the story, that was the key, and he was able to do that.
Mm. Well, thank you. I think we'll close with that. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.